Well, I'm not the vivacious Marianne Fraser, nor am I the articulate Jim Fraser, who's the neurobiologist and behaviorist on the group. And Marianne Fraser is handling most of the PR and most of the extension, so why am I up here? Well, I am a classical insect toxicologist. I have done a lot of work with pesticides. And I was brought on about a year ago to give some oversight to the pesticide analysis. As is usually the case, there's a three supervisors to one technician in the laboratory, Sarah Ashcraft, who is doing a lot of the work with the Ecotox, particularly the analysis of the pesticides relative to toxicity. So what is probably the rate-limiting step in doing pesticide analysis, particularly if you want a comprehensive approach, is to find a laboratory that can actually detect things in a way that the EPA will accept and as well as the industry will accept. And we were looking at residues that encompass the entire spectrum of polarity. So we were looking at both the in-hive, very lipophilic chemicals, to that of the most water-soluble pesticides. And to do this required coming to a compromise between the laboratory, which turns out to be the USDA AMS laboratory, and that of what was practical. But we wanted to look at the systemic compounds such as seed treatments because of their literature in regards to the European problem, and which turns out to be our problem too, perhaps. But and as well as we want to take a look at the sorts of chemicals that you can detect in a way that would be found in the wax of the beehives, so the in-hive chemicals. And this was a compromise between looking at detections in milk and as well as apple with seed treatments and in-hive chemicals to come up with a list of 171 pesticide active ingredients we were looking at. And we want to detect these at parts per billion levels. Well, this is a rather comprehensive approach, but at the same time, we found this laboratory. The laboratory was actually operated by an apiarist. The chemist was a consultant, was an apiarist. So we had his heart in regards to the problem. And so we dealt with both the trapped and pollen as well as the bee bread within the hive. We wanted to also take a look at the wax and then went to matrices that include the brood and the nectar and the adult bees and the royal jelly, and then as well as wanted to also take a look at the multitude of samples that have been generated by the colony collapse group, which included hundreds of samples from seven different states. So there's a lot of business on this slide, but I just want to point out the fact that in order to have an identity relative to pesticide, using a good laboratory practice in regards to a laboratory of this type requires using sophisticated instrumentation. We want to use a very efficient method. The method that turns out to be most useful was that of the catchers, which is taking your sample, squashing it up with solid absorbents as well as drying agents to get a very efficient movement of the chemicals into an acetonitrile or appropriate solvent. And then to use liquid chromatography in tandem with mass spectroscopy in a way, as well as GCMS, to quantitate both the involatile and the volatile chemicals respectively. Most of your systemics don't go through a GC, so you need to use both instrumentations. But in order to do this, this sort of analysis gives you a compounds that when you're trying to deal with finding or detecting a chemical at a certain retention time in a chromatogram, you need to know that So the identity is dependent on the retention time of the chemical being precise, the mass that is associated with that retention time being precise, and that the chemical fragments at least two transitions that are at the right rate ratio in order to be considered as a detection. So in the case of imidacloprid, you can see that there's two different fragmentations that are followed. The mass is 256. The one fragmentation goes to 175, which lops off a chlorine and a nitro group. And then another transition goes through 209, which is in relative to the nitro group just coming off. And unless those two transitions are satisfied, the detection is not going to be considered. So each chemical, each detection has to have all these criteria in order to be recognized. So with this, and among the 43 pesticides that we identified in our samples, just the pollen samples to date, that includes 92 samples, there were three in red at the top that were above or prevalent in the samples above the 50%. So most of the samples had coumaphos, most of the samples had chlorpyrifos, most of the samples had fluvalinate. And these are the detections that were found at least in 10% of the pollen samples. So here, the pyrethroids then are dominating, organophosphates are dominating. The endosulfan is a cyclodine insecticide that's found environmentally in lots of different matrices, but still being found a lot in the pollen samples. Chlorpyrifos is the organophosphate that is the a typical environmental chemical that's no longer used readily, but it still has some leftovers. And there's also, you can see there's lots of herbicides and fungicides, and we found seven different classes of insecticides within these samples. If we look at the highest residues that we found to date in the pollen, captan, which is a fungicide, was found at 10 parts per million in one sample, which skewed it a bit away from, there's a mean level here of 1.3 parts per million. But among the chemicals that are found at 50 parts per billion or above 50 parts per billion, you can see there's a number of neonicotinoids, thioclopride and acetamiprid were found in samples not frequently, but found in samples at above 50 parts per billion on a mean. Chlorpyrifos, and then going up the spectrum, there was an IGR, difluobenzuron, which is an insect chitin synthesis inhibitor. But the most prevalent samples or chemicals were, again, fluvalinate, coumaphos, and among the frequent samples. But surprisingly, a carbimate, autocarb, was found in some of the samples. At high levels, and the fungicides such as chlorothalonil, which is sometimes put in paint, which might be used around a hive, was also prevalent. So again, a lot of different chemicals, and the levels here are somewhat unprecedented for pollen samples. These are very high levels. So you're ranging to up 6 parts per million coumaphos in the samples. You're ranging up to 3 parts per million fluvalinate in these pollen samples. And again, up to 1.1, these are violations, of course, of autocarb and pollen. So what does this have to do with the toxicity of the chemistry? Well, Sarah Ashcraft has worked out a bioassay scheme. We can put 10 bees into a cage of this sort, which is primarily disposable. There's 10 bees can be either orally or topically exposed to the chemicals, providing an artificial nectar source. The humidity can be controlled. You can get a whole bunch of chambers together and do a bunch of assays. But we're just checking out what is already, there's some questions about the toxicology, or we're looking at interactions in these bioassays. There's a lot of literature already that's been generated that allows you to have LD50 values for most of the chemistry that we're using. And these are, if we look at the most toxic of the chemicals, the 17 most prevalent or toxic chemicals within the pollen samples, well, about half of those, 8 of them, were pyrethroids. There's, again, chlorpyrifos and fluvalinate among that group, or chlorpyrifos is the organophosphate, but again, the only neonicotinoid detection, imidacloprid, among the prevalent 17, was found in 7 of the samples at a level that would be considered to be a problem relative to what is known from the French studies in regards to sublethal effects. But relative to its frequency, again, it's not a prevalent sort of chemical within the samples that we've generated or looked at so far. So, in looking at just what has been done to date with pollen, we've seen up to 17 different pesticides per sample. On the average, it's 5. Only 3 of the samples lacked any detections whatsoever. And among these 43 different pesticides, there's also 5 other metabolites, 8 pyrethroids, 4 organophosphates, 4 carbamates, 3 neonicotinoids, 2 insect growth regulators, then a couple organochlorines and endosulfan. But there's also a lot of fungicides, and 13 different fungicides and 6 herbicides, but their levels are not as, the herbicides aren't considered at this point to be a problem, but the fungicides might be an issue. Now, at least 14 of these chemicals are systemic. In bee health, though, when we took a look at what we had and relative to pollen and tried to associate it with the colony collapse snapshot view that Dennis already mentioned in regards to the health of the colony at the sampling, looking at, the score of 4 was dead, 3 dwindling, 2 recovering, and 1 strong. There wasn't a really strong correlation between fluvalinate as a major player in the samples in regards to the bee health. Now, there could be different reasons for this. One is that it's a snapshot look. The other is that it's only looking at the pollen residues. So what about other matrices? And if we take it to the wax and take a look at what's going on in wax, then there's even more of a problem in regards to total amounts of chemical that were found. With fluvalinate, and this is still, we're only looking at a small set of the samples to date, but out of the first 18 samples that we sent to the facility, all of them had fluvalinate, all of them had Coumaphos. Coumaphos oxone is the primary active, it's the chemical that Coumaphos has to be metabolized to be active on insect at the target site, acetylcholinesterase. Those were in all the samples. Chlorpyrifos was basically in all the samples at lower levels. And the fungicide, surprisingly, this chlorothalonil showed up in the wax at fairly high frequency too. But you go down through that list, you have some odd fungicides, you have a number of miticides like dicofol also that could be associated with bees. There's an IGR methoxyphenoside that's present, and as well as some malathion. But again, it's the in-hive chemicals as well as chlorpyrifos and endosulfan, for example, as environmental prototypes that are prevalent in the wax. These levels for field samples in beeswax are not good. They're as high as a lot of the literature has for relative to experiments in the laboratory. So 34 parts per million or 17 parts per million Coumaphos, the fluvalinate as high as ever been detected in wax in regards to field samples. If we look at other matrices, and this is very, we're still just getting into this analysis, but and if you look at some of the in-hive matrices, brood, wax, and pollen relative to the hive that is control or strong or dwindling or dead in an operation, there's some tendency to increase the chemical residues relative to increasing toxicity. But for the most part, there's a fairly, the correlation is not strong. So while in some operations there is this tendency, others, their variability is a lot greater. And so right at this point, we cannot say with any definitive resolution on it that what's happening as far as pesticide residues is the only story. But again, this is a snapshot of the bee health and also The big problem is you're really looking at the leftovers in the samples. It's what's left over in the hive that actually is being measured in the samples and in the analysis. So we need to take all this back into the lab and get a better view of it by trying to look at what is actually interacting with the pesticides in regards to the other stress factors. The comic strips have pretty well advertised a lot about the colony collapse disorder. And if the bee situation is anything like the human situation, it's really just too many different stresses going on, too many players, and certainly pesticides is one of the players, but we need to also take a look at the other factors. It's a busy slide, but the other thing I want to point out is that even with fluvalinate, it's not clear. The toxicology known for fluvalinate alone is very kind of mixed in the literature. If you go through the background with this chemical, it was first noted to be a non-toxic chemical, LD50 of 65.8 micrograms per B, by Atkins way back in the early 70s. But as it went from company to company, Zoecon, Sandoz, and Wellmark, and then relative to its use, there was an improvement in the synthesis of the compound, so it made it increase the toxicity at least twice by taking out some of the inactive isomers. But even with that, the LD50s, if we go to the to 1992, the same laboratory was publishing a number of 8.8 micrograms per B for fluvalinate LD50, even when there's the toxicity hasn't really markedly been changed or shifted. Now, when EPA was re-registering this compound in 2005, they generated data that suggested that the LD50 is more in line with the other pyrethroids of 0.2 micrograms per B. So it went from being relatively non-toxic to a moderately toxic to a highly toxic chemical by EPA's definition for toxicity for honeybees. So this is one factor. The other is that as you were generating resistance in a hive to these chemicals in Europe and then as well as in the US, and then realized that really the first formulation, Maverick, was used first and then Apistan came with the strips later, there's when it doesn't work, then things happen in a hive. And so what is going on in a hive, if more of the chemicals being put in different formulations that can add other ingredients, then the game changes in regards to toxicity for the bee. And then Johnson and Berenbaum and et al. Have shown that you can even take this compound and add to it piperonyl butoxide as a synergist and make it extremely toxic. I mean, this is a 9 nanograms per B LD50, so that's acute toxicity, not looking at even sublethal effects. So there's a lot of issues in regards to just what is happening relative to all the different interactions that are possible with just this one product and this one detection alone. So our future goals are to address some of these main players relative to looking at the pesticides that we have found, whether they're hazardous to bees, particularly looking at the chlorpyrifos and coumaphos for valinate and other pyrethroids. We've seen 5 different pyrethroids in some samples. So just that alone and the impact pyrethroids are known to have on foraging behavior, just what might be in regards to the behavior, sublethal effects of these chemical residues on the what is used to identify colony collapse. So there's systemic fungicides. I mentioned mycobutanil and cyclodinil are found at high levels, enough of a level that they could synergize the co-occurring neonicotinoids or organophosphates or pyrethroids. The autocarb detections were noted mostly from Florida. Well, they were noted relative to citrus screening applications. And the other factor is that what we have done so far is mostly a monofactorial approach, and we need to test Dennis and others have mentioned already to go to looking at what is the interacting players and a multifactorial approach to analysis, particularly whether or not pesticides are stress factor or trigger for what is the virus that's going to be mentioned in just a few moments and other viruses that have been detected relative to CCD. So The other thing is inerts are not inert. And when you throw adjuvants into the system, you're changing the toxicology dramatically. So we want to reconstitute all this into laboratory situations where we can know what the bees are exposed to, what they ingest, and what the impact is on the pesticide or the honeybee health. To do this, we're doing other, we're carrying on studies that are real life situations of apples, both in conventional and reduced risk blocks within Pennsylvania. We're looking at neonics and homeowner products in regards to consequences to nectar pollen, and as well as using solitary bees. With Dennis Van Engelsdorp, we're tracking three migratory operations relative to pesticide incidents in regards to the health of the colony. And we're trapping pollen from colonies in different cropping systems to get an idea of just the complexity. And at the same time, we're investigating possible interactions with viruses such as the Israeli acute paralytic virus with Diana Cox Foster as the major collaborator. So I'd like to thank just our particularly the funding sources, the National Honey Board, and the Beekeepers Associations that have helped to make this possible, and as well as the NC508 and the Hatch funds that have been used to fund this work. And as well as the collaborators in the Colony Collapse Disorder Working Group and others that are associated with Penn State that have, again, provided resources in order to accomplish what we're doing. And with that, I'll entertain, no, I won't entertain a question. Thank you.